This is Philosophy versus Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well.
My name is Bill Arnett, an improv district manager, yet only a philosophy temp.
And this is Mark Linsenmeyer, a philosophy, I'm also going to say district manager, but an improv assistant to the assistant district manager.
Sure, sure. The one that gets under everyone's skin. Yeah.
Yes, yes. and we have a special guest today. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Greg McBrayer. I failed at both philosophizing and stand-up comedy, and so I'm backup janitor now at the Improv. Slop Bucket was my nickname, actually.
But you have employment at a university.
I do. Yeah, I'm actually an associate professor at Ashland University. It's in Ohio, and I actually just accepted, I don't know if you guys can tell, the audience may not be able to tell, but I'm in a big empty office because I've just accepted the job of interim provost.
Whoa.
Which I think was probably the dumbest thing I've ever said yes to in my life.
Interim provost is a way better title, Bill, than we came up with for...
Oh, it's a fantastic title.
That's right. I made it up myself.
Well, it's one of those academia jobs that doesn't exist in the real world. I can't go find a provost.
No.
You know,
Apple doesn't have one.
What do you want to be when you grow up, kids? I want to be a provost.
Yeah.
We interviewed a guy one time for a job at the university, and he began the interview by saying, ever since I was 18 and first stepped foot on a campus, I knew I wanted to be a university president. And I thought, what a soul this human being has just revealed to me.
Yes.
who wants to do that at 18?
Yeah.
I mean, is it a kind of a, not quite like being a CEO, but, you know, being able to be a tyrant over your domain?
Yeah, I guess that's it. No checks on power, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you also run a podcast. Tell us about your podcast.
Yeah, I do a podcast. I have two co-hosts, Alex and David, and we run a podcast called The Partially Examined. Wait, no, that's you guys. I do one called The New Thinkery. It's fairly modest. We've been going about 4 or 5 years. We try to do sort of serious interpretations of texts with also fart jokes and stuff like that looped in, you know?
Please. More, please.
More fart jokes, right?
Yes.
Yeah. We do a lot of Plato, Aristotle, that kind of thing. We will do movies, and you know, our name comes from Aristophanes, so we do try to be a little bit PG-13 in our humor. I play the straight guy on that show.
All right. Well, you can kind of cut loose here and be the wild card and the joker, and Mark and I roll in our eyes. It's funny because I usually badger Mark on this show about... Tell me about the ancients. What did the ancients say about this or that? And it's nice, Mark, for you to have another authority to appeal to.
Someone who cares more about the ancients, in fact.
I love the ancients. All things old.
So it seems like it's a little bit of a new thing for actual professors to make the time to podcast. I feel like this was not a thing when I started 15 years ago, that it's really only been... Now that I think of it, we probably had a few others on it, but most of the time we either have podcast hosts or professors who are writing books, not necessarily both. How do you do it all? How do you be a provost and run a podcast?
It's a good question. A lot of AI generated work
There we go.
It's not easy. You're right. It's sort of difficult to balance it all, but it's a lot of fun. And you know, I think if it weren't with two of my friends, it'd be a different story. But
sure.
I've taught at a bunch of these places where you're on like a 4-4 or 4-5 teaching load, that sort of stuff. So I have a pretty broad wealth of things that I have at least like nickel deep worth of knowledge on. And so I thought, where else could I do this except a podcast? And also it's just becoming more serious and more legitimate. I mean, and it shows a couple of things. I'm sure you know this from the Partially Examined Life, but just there's a hunger out there, it seems, outside of the academy for actual discussion of philosophical things. You know, we get notes from lawyers, bankers, people who just stay at home and work. And it's just like, wow, I haven't read this stuff since I was in college, or, you know, I've never read this stuff. And it's a neat way to connect with folks. And I think it has resounded to my benefit, I think, in academia. But even more than that, I just think it's a pleasure to actually know that people are out there listening and having fun.
All right. So you're not hiding it actively within the academic circles.
No. I'm sure it hurts me in some circles, but in some, it, you know, who cares at this point?
And had you really done stand-up comedy at some point?
No.
Okay.
My very first faculty position, I was a visiting professor, and they do some stupid icebreaker, come around the room and say something about yourself. You know, it's so dumb.
Sure.
And I said, well, I'll tell you two things. One is I played minor league baseball in the St. Louis Cardinals system, and two, I make up stories about myself to sound more impressive to people I don't know. And for years, other people came up like, man, it's so impressive. You played minor league baseball. And I thought, did you not hear the second part?
Second one, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, they're just two unrelated statements.
Yeah, that's right. Unrelated statements. So
yeah, I make up some things, not everything.
Right. So
yeah. But you mentioned you teach a lot of different classes. Yeah. Is there one you like the most? Or is there an aspect, if you could design your own philosophy curriculum, you know, what do you think we're going to hit?
Right. Well, I like the ancients, like Mark. So I've gotten to teach classes on Xenophon, who's I particularly like. I'm teaching a class right now on rhetoric, which is a lot of fun. So I'm working sort of through Aristotle's rhetoric with contemporary and ancient speeches. And so that's a lot of fun, sort of seeing how these speeches live up to or don't live up to the sort of things that Aristotle's talking about. We have a book that talks about rhetorical devices. So that's a lot of fun. I mean, I've done a class called Socrates and Alcibiades, where I sort of look at the political career of this very impressive, sort of brilliant young Athenian guy and spectacular failure. I love teaching classes on the Republic. That's typically an upper level class for me. Mm-hmm. Man, anything ancient, really. I love Thucydides. I love teaching Aristophanes. I'd love to do a class on that. I've taught Gulliver's Travels. I did a reading group on Moby Dick. And so I try to branch out into anything that's kind of interesting to me at any given moment. I'd really love to teach some of Aristotle's logical and scientific writings, but that might be a bit of a stretch for a political scientist. They might
frown
upon that a little bit. So
I just heard that Socrates was ugly. Is that true?
I heard he was young and beautiful from a letter. So, and I don't know if you've seen Jacques-Louis David's The Death of Socrates. He may have been ugly, but he was jacked. I mean, he was ripped, right?
Oh, I did not see that. I don't know how it came across. Someone had mentioned something, who had mentioned something, that relied on someone else, maybe one of the playwrights. If you wanted to have Socrates in your play, you need to have someone waddle out with a big gin blossom nose.
Yeah, apparently he had like bug eyes and like they looked different directions and he sort of shuffled and walked weird like a pelican or something like this.
Okay, okay.
And he was chubby, had a fat, had a little paunch. He looked like a satyr, apparently. He's likened to a satyr in the symposium.
Okay.
Which, yeah, not exactly very attractive.
Yeah.
I mean, they did bring that up in his trial.
That's right.
Did they really?
Yeah.
I mean, what are we losing here? We're not losing a 10. Let's just be perfect. Yeah. Sorry, ladies.
That's the original stand-up, is Plato's Socrates' apology to the jury there, right? Guys, I'm just a country bumpkin. I don't know your ways.
Yeah.
Those Athenians, they have the wrong values. They're all focusing on the nipping and the tucking.
Right.
Actually, I don't know to what extent facial makeup was in vogue in the ancient days.
Very primitive facial reconstructive surgeries back in the ancient Greeks.
Well, just like, oh, I'm going to go in front of the jury. I need to put a little rouge. I need to have a little dirt.
Like probably cosmetic.
Just dirt at the time.
We're just removing dirt. Where do you remove dirt?
You're using like lead, right? Which is sort of really healthy long-term stuff to put on your face to make you.
White lead. Yeah. In a lot of things.
Well, this is related. I don't think I've announced this on the air that I just discovered recently. I'm now recording in an upstairs location because my normal basement studio, apparently, for the 15 years that I was recording, has several times the recommended level of radon in it.
Oh, no.
And that was not a thing that they tested on when we bought the house.
Oh, no.
But now, apparently, that is a thing. And so now a big straw has been – I mean, it's lung cancer and stuff.
Lung cancer.
And I don't know.
Anything good, right? Like radon exposure makes you very handsome. Oh, that's great.
Oh, good. Okay.
Probably. Yeah. At least you seem more handsome to yourself.
Yeah, all right.
You don't need a nightlight. Yeah. You are a nightlight. Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Mark. I hope everything – you're having it mitigated, I'm presuming.
It has been mitigated. We're waiting for the effects of the mitigation, the straw that is slurping the gases out of the soil and spewing them outside somewhere to complete its work. Now I've gotten spoiled. Now that I've come up from the cave and I have natural lighting available to me, it's going to be hard to – go back down there. I don't know if I can do that.
You know, it's funny. I know we always, and again, this might be a little philosophical. Here we go.
Yes, please. We need to stumble on something quick. Keep going.
Yeah, land on something here. We usually think of things that are natural as being healthy, you know, rather farm to table than get the factory out of there and whatnot. Yet radon is perfectly, you know, the earth is just leaking this stuff. You know, it's just kind of coming out. It's not healthy. Generally, I mean,
I don't know. Maybe it makes teens extra horny, and that's the sort of what's being selected for.
In small doses, certainly our bodies do have a mechanism for repairing that kind of damage, or, you know, anytime you fly in an airplane, that would, that's that, you know, but, especially probably young children and old people who sleep on the floor, of their basements. But it's just this idea of like, you know, the earth is actually quite indifferent towards us.
No, it's hostile to us. It's not indifferent. I mean, like, what percentage of the earth is habitable? Like 1% or something like this? Like,
yeah,
constantly the earth, I think everything's trying to kill you. Fire, rain, animals, bears. You know,
and there, you know, there may have been a earlier Homo sapien-like creature that came about in a very different world that we would think of as very, very different than our normal. But it, you know, died out or got killed by Neanderthals or something.
I thought we ate them all.
Yeah, it's just a coincidence that we are here now and we call now normal, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I want to teach another class. You mentioned this a moment ago. What class did I teach? I want to teach a class on sort of man on a deserted island across the millennia and see what sort of writings there are. There's a great medieval text called Hayy ibn Yaqsan about a medieval mystic who he's alone on a desert island. He communes with God and sort of, right?
Sure.
And you think about like Robin Crusoe, right? Early modern man, what does he do? He conquers the island, right? He figures out how to make it his own. You, me, I mean, maybe you guys are more handy than I am, but if I were stranded on a desert island, it would be more like Castaway. I'd have no idea what in the hell I'm doing. I'd have to rediscover fire.
Yeah.
He struggles to make it go there.
I'm sure there's probably some reflection about the society that the writer lives in and their value. And, you know,
oh, yeah, there. Exactly. Yeah, I think that's right.
That's what the class would be about.
Yeah, kind of.
I'm presuming.
Okay. Yeah, of course. That's right.
Yes, this is a very good topic. So the idea of naturalness, I mean, it's just like, you know, that you can reflect on the mores of the age by looking at their science fiction.
Yes.
And what they think the future is. Well, naturalness tells you something about what they think of a idealized past.
Right, right,
built
right.
Out of what seems natural to me now.
Right, right, right.
Sure.
And all these people like, I want my food natural and organic, like you said, right? And it's like, no pesticides. Like, well, pesticides, you know, they kind of do some good occasionally. You know, we're not dying of.
Yeah.
It's kind of helpful, actually.
I know there's a big thing now with people trying to go back to raw milk. No more pasteurizing, homogenizing milk. And I'm not saying that all milk purveyors at the turn of the prior century were all honest.
Right.
But babies were dying, but straight up dying from bad milk.
Right.
And we can get rid of pasteurizing if you can guarantee me that babies won't die.
That seems like a fair trade. You might have a hard bargain, Bill, but I'll take it.
I hope plan B is better than just picking up where we left off in 1890.
Have you seen this raw meat on X? There's this guy who's like enormously jacked, and he's sort of peddling the idea that you can eat meat raw. But I think it was, I think it was just a scam. He's clearly just on steroids. Going one step farther than the raw milk.
Yeah.
Yes, we always have built into the idea of naturalness, not just that it's a descriptive of what is, but a descriptive of the systems, of the telos,
right,
of the purposes within a given thing. So it is natural not for us to be out in the cold and die, but to search for ways to supplement our natural gifts. That the artificial is in fact natural. We are social creatures. We are naturally social creatures. We are naturally industrial creatures.
Yeah.
And that opens the door to just about anything being natural.
That's right.
Anything that's good.
Well, I'm sure people throw natural around all kinds of things to support their own agenda, be it gender roles or male roles or how the world should be. Well, look what's natural. That's natural. It's natural to be this way or not that way.
Well, fellas, the word has come in from the federal government. Now the post office is remaking itself au natural. We're supposed to be more frugal. We're supposed to let communications get where they need to go in a more natural way. I guess it's a little hard to make sense of some of these vague guidelines. So I wanted to, you know, our greatest minds. Yes, Mr. Arnett.
Usually when I hear au naturel, I think naked. Are you saying we need to drive trucks and deliver mail
Let
naked?
Me listen. Let me write that on the board. There are no bad ideas. Mr. McBrady, do you think the budgets for the uniforms, wasn't that a significant portion, that if we could lessen that and let people, maybe not naked, but like what they'd be wearing anyway?
Listen, the true Socratic view, of course, would be one article of clothing that they wear year-round and they don't need shoes, right? So they can just toughen up and walk. Yeah, it would save a ton of money. It'd be more efficient. They'd probably get their jobs done quicker, especially in the winter. They want to be done.
I still have a route that I run as ombudsman of the post office. I try to keep a hand in both fields a little bit here. You know, rain, sleet, or snow, nothing's... I think clothes and footwear are probably going to be necessitated by that vow that we all take.
Yes, as vice provost of the yeah. post office, I too retain a route, because all executives, as we know, in the post office retain a route so that we're in touch with the common people.
Obviously.
And can make these decisions in a very up, down, down, up, sideways, all the ways, all the directions. But the wardrobe thing, I'm not sure about.
I mean, you have to have the satchel though, right? I mean, you got to have the satchel. You got to reach in. You got to have something to grab in there. So that's important. Maybe we could do double duty.
I don't want to be naked. I don't want to be. Is any who raise your hand if you're pro naked? Can we just cut to the chase here? Is that what we're being told to do?
Naked might be okay if there are other factors involved. So, for instance, from warmth, if you're carrying a satchel that is very, very heavy and either has some sort of heating system in it, or you're just having to work so hard to drag the satchel around that you're generating the heat that you need. So maybe sort of a food tube, just however the warmth gets to you. It seems like whatever the most natural way.
A food tube.
I mean, that's the natural way. There's a tube in your throat.
Yeah, it's
a tube.
Just like when you're a baby, you have a food tube. Why shouldn't adults have food tubes?
I like eating. I enjoy the act of eating. I don't – look, maybe if – I'll tell you what. If someone's in a truck
yeah.
and you can't see them, maybe if they would like to be naked, they could be naked.
Right.
But certainly any service letter carrier who's on foot – the socks pulled up. I mean, that's kind of the look, isn't it? You know, the shorts and pith helmet. Are we really going to get rid of that?
I suppose that is what has become the natural attire of a postman. I just don't want any of this sort of eco-friendly, we're going to, and I know ecological seems like it's the same as natural, but I think it's more the, we're going to have the sort of hat that distributes a breeze across your body. I know these innovations that have been released recently have been popular, but the new administration is having none of them.
None of it.
They're going to buy us hats with fans in them to keep us cool so we can deliver mail naked?
You don't have one of those?
No, I don't.
Sorry, I've been using one of those for 2 years now. Those are sweet. I'm going to really miss that, but you know, we got to go with the recommendations.
How about a t-shirt? You can wear street clothes as long as you wear a special USPS t-shirt.
So what would be the most natural kind of t-shirt?
A t-shirt? I don't know what's more natural than a t-shirt. Is there anything more ubiquitous? What percentage of the population sleeps in a t-shirt? Where's a t-shirt around the house?
Mr. Greer, what is the most natural t-shirt material?
Leather.
I think that sounds pretty good. I mean, it's from an actual animal.
Yeah.
Ideally, we should not be providing the leather. I think that
part of
the training,
right,
as was in the days of old, should be to go out and acquire the leather, acquire the beef.
I'm pretty sure that the original post office, which was invented by Benjamin Franklin in 1602, mm-hmm. the original postmen tanned their own hides, and that's what they used as they had to make the difficult trek across the continent to deliver mail.
Would make their own leather S&M gear.
That's right.
To deliver the mail. That's what you're saying.
People don't really know that the chaps that are just the front, they actually started out full body, but they wore down over the course of the moving from east to west, and they just didn't hold up for the entire trip.
And the leather would be as removable. I mean, I know on my route,
obviously,
the reason I retain the route is because of the amount of sexual congress that I get during the route. I mean, it's sort of a classic, I'd say, natural part of our jobs to anyone who's lonely on the route. Then, at least we get the option to partake.
Postman never rings twice.
I'm getting the idea, Mr. Arnett, that you're not taking advantage of all the current services.
No, I'm delivering the mail. I'm delivering the mail. I get a bag, I have a route, I have my letters, and I deliver them efficiently and crisply. And I am proud to wear the uniform. I'm proud to have that flag on my shoulder. And I think that my employer, the U.S. Postal Service, should cover the expense of my uniform. And I think that that is only fair. And being uniformed, I think, shows the dignity of the office and shows that we are a part. You know, one of the few jobs actually mentioned in the Constitution other than politician is the post office. And I think, there's nothing more American than the post office.
It's just that in Dodgers v. Tibbs 1948, it clearly says, and the administrations have followed this even to the present day, that delivering the mail is a euphemism.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's just a recognition of the reality.
It's both. Can it be both? Can it be? I mean, if something is only a euphemism, well, then it's not a euphemism anymore, is it?
It just means something else.
It has to have a second meaning, doesn't it? Can't it have one meaning?
I mean, for the rubes.
The rubes. I see. I thought we had originalist interpretations of the court here. Apparently, we're just whatever it means. It's in the text. It's,
so that was an activist judge, and you think that's going to be overturned pretty soon.
He was overturning tradition, the letter tradition.
Okay, so fine, delivering the mail could involve actual mail and actual delivering, but I feel like we are going to need some court interpretations, and we should definitely go on originalist lines as to what the vision of the organization is. Yes, we deliver mail, but what is our vision? What did the original founders, what was it? Benjamin Franklin, key, electricity.
That pony that helped.
Ponies, Pony Express.
Right.
Pigeons. I think more animals involved in mail delivery is more natural.
What are they doing now? They're just lying around most of the time, they contribute nothing to society, the pets.
Animals or postal workers?
That's right.
Well, I don't know if pigeons have a lot to gain from society rather than rummaging through our garbage, eating the odd popcorn or french fry. I think it would be more expensive if you bring back mules. I'm not going to lie. I think that would actually be cost more to house and feed than it is to just gas up the little carrier route vehicle.
Does the Fourth Amendment prohibiting, among other things, the housing of soldiers in private homes, is that the Fourth Amendment or is that
okay? Yeah, that's right. No quartering.
The no quartering. That include, are mules, public mules allowed to just eat your grass?
Does that count as quartering of soldiers?
That's what I'm trying to figure out, because it would be a lot cheaper if we can just, as part of the delivery, say while you're engaging in sexual congress with one of your many customers, the mule can be out eating the lawn. Obviously in urban areas that this raises additional problems, but you know, there is garbage. Maybe that's where the pigeons serve.
Yeah.
The mules will eat the pigeons. Is that what you're suggesting?
the pigeons can serve the urban areas. The mules, the more suburban with lawns.
How many pigeons does it take to carry a catalog?
Nobody gets catalogs anymore, Bill.
Catalogs are quite unnatural.
They're unnatural. We got to get, except for Aristotle's catalog of the categories, then that's totally natural. That's fine. But yes, if they're delivering that.
But that's surprisingly short.
It is very. There's only 10 of them. So how long could it be? Just a page?
Yeah, it's not like that Sears catalog with all the nudie pictures.
I remember those. Good old days. Things have changed. That was natural.
I mean, for the time. I guess that's the issue, is how do you give, and I know this doesn't sound very originalist, and maybe this will be a problem, but how do you give, it seems like the natural has to reflect what is natural at that point in time. Cannibalism might have been natural in some societies, but it's only rarely natural now.
Really frowned upon now. Yeah. People don't like that so much.
Good. So you're not going to ask the letter carriers to eat each other?
Well, I mean, you already frowned upon the food tube. So what are we going to do now? Yeah,
that could go on for another 3 weeks.
Yes.
The nature of business meetings, especially planning meetings, even if it's a bunch of nonsense, means, we've hit 90 minutes. Let's take a little break and then come back.
A little lunch, a little nibble.
And continue to get nothing done. Yes.
All right. So what did we learn about naturalness other than what had been said? I feel, does this serve any positive purpose using this terminology as an ethical principle? I want to be natural. More natural, because it does seem like there are some things that are positively unnatural. Look, that severance and living in that basement with your mind cut in half and you can never escape. That seems very unnatural. I would vote against that.
Yeah, it does seem unnatural. I think you're right that it can be abused, that people kind of just say it's sort of a justification for whatever they happen to find interesting at that particular moment. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, you know, being the good Aristotelian, I do want to say that the telos, the end of something, is sort of given to us by nature or something like this. Aristotle even talks about this for other animals, right? When we're looking, you know, like mules, for example, mules probably the best example of an animal that we put the goal on. It can't even reproduce itself.
Yeah.
And so there is this danger that you're mentioning.
You're welcome. You're welcome, mules.
Which means they can have all the party fun and don't have to worry about paying the bills later. So maybe they're the luckiest critters of all time. I don't know. But you're right. Even there, Aristotle, I think, is pointing to the danger of trying to, like he talks about, what's the purpose of a horse? It's to wear a bridle to go to war. Like, well, that's obviously not the purpose of a horse. I think he's making a joke there that, like, we tend to look at animals like we look at everything else through human eyes and sort of put onto it the human version of the goal of nature for that thing. So I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you. I know that I don't like unnatural.
There's a chunk of our humanness that I would probably say is natural. Mm-hmm. Certainly pain and hunger, and perhaps you want to throw love or procreation, or, you know, there are some things around that I think you could probably say are natural. Maybe some things that are probably instinctual or cats like cardboard boxes. I think that's, they didn't even have cardboard boxes when cats were invented.
What did they do before they were boxes?
Yeah.
So it seems like Darwinism undid Aristotelianism, that before Darwin, anytime you could argue that something is a native capability, well, it could just be that it's a native risk, but you could at least recast it as, well, you've got the natural faculty that the way that it's pushing, and then you got perversions of it. You got ways in which it might pull you a little too far in some direction. Yeah. And even that is opening the idea to, like, yes, it is natural for us to want to have sex with as many people as possible because, per Darwinism, that's right. Why we're here, because we're the ones whose ancestors did that.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, we don't have to think that that is the good.
No, of course not. But there, I mean, it does seem like, right, there. So speech seems natural to man. It seems like if you met a human being who lacked the capacity for speech, you would sort of – I mean, none of us would want to lack that capacity.
Sure.
And none of us would want to lack the capacity for vision to see, for example, although, of course, there are people who are blind. But so there is something in us that seems to long for or is only completed by speaking and talking, and even just yucking it up is kind of maybe a sort of a salutary way that we pay lip service to it. But this is something I struggle with. I've actually been working through Aristotle's Natural Writings right now, trying to figure out what it means to be a being. But, you know, I think that Aristotle may have actually been aware of some of the things that Darwin's talking about. I mean, there have even some hints of the notion that species aren't eternal in Aristotle, which is definitely not very commonly thought of him. But that's not nearly as funny. But mules are funny. I do think he makes jokes about animals, by the way.
I don't know if either of y'all are familiar with the whole, maybe this is a bit off topic, but you mentioned speech being natural, the whole debate on how best to teach children how to read. And there were two primary camps,
right?
And it turned out one camp, which came about in the 70s and 80s into the 90s, really gained traction in the 90s, is less efficient, is less good. Yet the publishers of those books and the writers of those books are standing to make or have made millions of hundreds of millions of dollars and don't want to just let a pesky thing like clinical testing that proves the lack of viability of their product to get in the way of that money spigot.
I'm forgetting, is it phonics that is the natural way or is not the natural
way? The not natural way is called cueing.
Cueing?
C-U-E, cue. And it's to look for visual, hey, is there a picture? What does that picture mean? What's the first letter? You know, what they don't say is sound it out. And the phonics way of learning is all about sound it out. And one of the, there's a lot more science to do, but this idea that we speak, babies will babble without being told to babble.
Yeah.
For most of humanity, people could speak quite well without being able to read or write.
Right.
You know, there may be some great minds out there who are actually didn't know their letters very well, but other people would write for them, write things down for them.
Is that why Socrates didn't write things down? Because he couldn't read?
He was illiterate, little known fact.
Yeah. But this idea that phonics harnesses the natural thing we have towards language and hitches that train by attaching language to words. Kids read out loud before they read in their head. We all read out loud. And this whole idea of like, no, these words you see, which are completely idiosyncratic and have no natural, no meaning, we're going to put meaning on them, but it's identical to all these little sounds you've been making this entire time.
That's great. I actually have a toddler. He's only a year and a half old. So I've been thinking a lot about this language acquisition stuff. It's kind of fun. And I was reminded recently of in Herodotus, maybe Mark knows it better than I do, but there's this Egyptian king who wants to figure out what's the natural language because there's some argument over what language is natural. And so this is exactly what I want to do, but my wife, she said no. So what he takes a baby and he puts it on a desert island with no other people around to figure out what language the baby's going to speak, right? Because then we'll know. My wife, Hannah, was like, you can't put our baby on a desert island to see what language he speaks. She wasn't a fan of that. So I think it's a goat, actually, keeping with our animal theme today. And the king is surprised when he's like, oh, look, the baby has the natural word for goat, which is baa. And so therefore, this language where it begins with a B is the correct language, not realizing maybe this baby was just imitating, you know, human is also the mimetic creature. It's probably just imitating the sound. So your question, Bill, about the, like, is there some sort of natural connection between the arbitrary words we have and words, I think is a really good one. I don't know the answer to that, but I do wonder how many of these words were onomatopoeic at the beginning and then through various hooks and crooks and crannies.
Totally.
It is amazing in the Platonic dialogue, the Cratylus, I believe is right. Yes, about language, that it was a significant thing, which I think Socrates is arguing against throughout, that all words can be appropriate or inappropriate, that the message had not gotten uniformly accepted, that the association between a word and its object is merely conventional.
Right.
That there are a few words, at least, that are onomatopoetic, and so probably all names, for instance, at least, could be rightly ascribed or wrongly ascribed. So, yeah, Bill, you don't look like a Bill. You look more like a... You look more like a Frank.
I was teaching the Republic a few years ago, and I remember the kids – I just mentioned in passing that, you know, the names actually – and of course, it's a poetic device, and so the names can mean stuff, right? Like Thrasymachus means like fierce battler or something like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Glaucon means like bright shining. Adam, anyway, Cephalus, head of the – he's the head of the family. And I was going on and on about this, and I was thinking – I have a student who is changing his or her name in class, and I just mentioned in passing that names are kind of conventional. They don't really mean anything. But then I got to thinking about the way in which parents name their children, and I do wonder if there's – intentionally or not. I don't think it's like I gave you this name and therefore it empowers you to behave this way. But I wonder if there's a kind of the parents are trying to make this young person become a certain type. And if this person sort of internalizes that or rebels against it even. So like I'll give you an example, simple example. I've never met a young woman named Bella who wasn't kind of cute. Like, that's just weird. Like, how is that possible?
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's examples like that. And there are other ones, right? And you mentioned he doesn't look like a Bill. But, like, if I mention there's certain names, Chad. I imagine a certain image of a certain human type conjures up into your mind. Karen, right? So they're all, there are these weird ways in which naming things does seem to try – you're trying to control and make what that thing is in some way.
Yeah. Oh, I bet there's probably someone has done some sociological digging to find people with actual names, you know, Stephen Danger or something, or people like who have strange nouns for names or names with, you know, and again, we talk about, you know, names having meaning, you know, William was a warrior, but we don't, that meaning is lost to us. It's just a name now.
Cases. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, in most cases, yeah. But there are still people with names that very much do have connections, you know, and I wonder, I'm sure, come on, sociology, get it.
Yeah, right. Give the program.
If I name my kid Gandalf, will they?
He's probably going to turn out in a particular way.
or hate me. One of the two.
Yeah. Isn't that was that XFL player, right? He Hate Me was his name?
He Hate Me. Oh, yeah.
That's why we have the towering intellect of Musk naming his children in mysterious ways.
Right. I mean, you walk into your doctor's office, he's like, hi, I'm He Hate Me Jones. You're going to be like, is there another doctor available?
It's a foreign name.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Oh, then it's okay. All right.
Way back in the early days of YouTube or of like social media was a very, we got to put it in the show notes, Mark. Some guy who was at the London airport, maybe Heathrow or something, and he would wait for an international flight to land and ask for people to be paged. And it would be these ridiculous names. If you try to pronounce it phonetically, would make things in English. And here's your fart joke, Greg. There was straight up one that was like, my colleague just farted. Please call the white courtesy phone. It's
like, hey, listen, fart jokes are funny. I don't care who you are. You talk about natural versus conventional. I think when I'm teaching comedies with my students, I'll get them to, like, why is this funny? Is it naturally funny to man or is it sort of conventionally funny, right? Like man in a dress, is that naturally funny or conventionally funny?
Yeah.
Well, it's conventionally funny, right? Scotsmen wear dresses and people don't laugh. And now, of course, there's increasing gender fluidity. People see it's a lot. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people would have found this stuff more funny. But like farting seems to be fairly universally funny, right? Like,
yeah.
Like babies laugh at it, foreigners laugh at it, Americans laugh at it, women, men.
Yeah.
Imagine the Queen of England farting and it's funny.
So in the Cratylus, they don't address the farting noise.
It's too bad.
But I think that he acknowledges the compound words that we've been talking about, the Native American name, you know, you're a running bull and you're, you know, so if you, that Greece had its equivalent, but then supposedly, according to this theory that I think Socrates is arguing against, the individual syllables would have some sort of core meaning from which the compound meanings would be derived. So, you know, if it has a la, 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 that means it's like the flowing of water. So it either refers ultimately to change, to movement, to flow, or static, you know, any
stopping
phonetics without stopping are referring to the stopping of the universe.
That's really something else. So, that's a heck of a dialogue to try and work through in English. So, I mean,
yes, there's lots of footnotes. There's
I imagine.
I guess I was just going to roll us into our now customary over two episodes, second segment, so we can kind of finish this off.
Sure.
And I think I'm feeling bold enough to give you the theme song. Do you want the theme song?
I would love the theme song.
All right, I'll pull the mic around. See if I can. It's time to go to Empty Street. It's time to go to Empty Street. It's time to go to Empty Street, where the streets are full of basically nothing. We now move into our combination Subway Taco Bell, run by Glenn. Does Glenn have a last name?
We will discover it.
Glenn's last name is yet to be revealed.
That's a weird last name. We will discover it. Is that German?
Yes. Yeah.
And our guest, throwing him in the deep end, now he's gotten comfortable with us,
yeah,
is visiting this place, and perhaps I will chime in at some point. Proceed.
Yes. Hello, sir. How are you? You can get gas at the pumps or head to the convenience store or grab some lunch here. I'm just getting the trash together here.
10-4, big buddy. Copy that.
You on the road?
Yeah, you know, got a big load. Them smokies out there today, though, they're everywhere. Even some bears in the sky. I don't know if you know that. Over.
Okay. Yeah. You don't have to do radio CB jargon. We're just talking.
But I'm pretty accustomed to it. I don't really know any other way.
Fair enough. Yeah, we get a lot of long-haul guys in here. Feel free to take a load off. We do have some showers if you want to do that.
No, I stopped doing that.
Showering or just showering at truck stops?
Showering at truck stops.
Okay. Fair enough. We do try to keep it clean here. So,
the showers are pretty good.
Oh, yeah?
You might want to try it out.
All right. Well, now it's more interesting.
Okay. All right. You're here?
Yeah.
I slept in the shower this time. I hope that wasn't out of line. It wasn't being used for the most part.
Okay, you slept in the shower. That's not what shower is not made for sleeping.
I mean, what is made for what? It's, you know, when something is, the intentions of a creator don't necessarily spill over. Everything has a multitude of uses. Like this, shirt, you think this was made to be a shirt?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you can press it into other uses, but I think the person who was weaving it was thinking to themselves, this is a great shirt I'm weaving.
Look closer. This second layer, that's a paper bag. There's the cloth and then the paper bag, you can layer.
How did it stay dry in the shower?
You don't have the shower on.
Oh.
There's multiple parts to the shower. There's the surface at the bottom of the shower, and then there's the water that comes down.
Right.
And you don't necessarily have to have both to be using the shower.
You're just lying on the floor of the shower.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, there's some residual, but you know, there's a drain. Most places where you lie, where there's moisture, not a drain. This is
a major step up.
Perfectly designed as a place to sleep.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Hey, I'll just buy you a t-shirt from the convenience store. It's fine. All right. If you need a new shirt, all right. I'm sure we have some last year Super Bowl shirts or something, you know, or we can get you this.
I wanted to hear more about the trucking with no showering. What does that mean for the state of the truck?
Just slows me down, man. I'm trying to get my stuff from here to there, you know, 40 days on the road. Shower when I get home. No time, you know? Hammer down. My lady, she don't care. And them lizard lot girls, they don't care neither. They take your money.
Okay, we try to keep a clean establishment here, just so FYI.
Oh, no lizard ladies?
You know, if there are, I try to run them off as best I can.
Fair enough. Good on you.
Okay.
Down behind the Kmart, just a couple blocks down, that's where, you know, if you want to get some...
Allegedly. Bird spends a lot of time here, let me just say.
I know the lay of the land.
Kmart parking lot. I'll check it out.
Yeah, mostly the back parking lot, so the sort of where the truck pulls up.
That's where they used to have the blue light special, right, Kmart?
Yeah.
They still have the blue light special. Oh. It's sort of blue all the time. It's a strange aesthetic in that place. I think they're trying to preserve some sort of – they realize there are not many of these stores left, and they're trying to preserve some of the mystique of the past. And so it sort of has a glow about it, like I'm in 1955.
The heyday.
Okay. Now, Bert, this gentleman here has just got off the road, probably wants a cold drink and some food or something. You know, maybe we can leave him be, huh?
Yeah, that sounds good.
So what are you hauling?
Mules.
See? You didn't expect that, Glenn. Mules.
No, I didn't. I didn't know they still made mules.
Yeah, old bugger's got a big full busload of mules right now. That's what they call me on my CB handle, bugger.
Jesus Christ, that's a long truck. How many mules you got in that?
Well, we started with 50.
Started.
Do you lose some on the road, or they gain more because you've figured out some way for them? Are they super mules that can reproduce?
We're down to 47.
Okay.
Yeah, I had to eat one.
How many until it comes out of your paycheck? Do they give you some?
They expect you to skim off the top.
Some lossage, some leakage.
If they expect me to pull in with a full freight of mules, that's on them. That doesn't make any sense. Everybody knows you're going to lose at least 5, 6, 7 mules.
Is it the combat? Are you having to sell them as you go for parts?
Stress from just being in the back of a truck?
It's the heat. It's the lack of air conditioning back there.
Is it better to bring the mule corpse the rest of the way, or is it better to just, where do you leave it?
They don't fetch as high a price, no, the corpses, but you can still get a good pretty penny on them for the hides.
Okay, so you got 47 plus 3 dead mules.
Well, 2 dead mules.
So wait, what?
Did you lose one?
Well, he died, but he's not with us anymore either.
It's skimming off the top.
I skimmed off the top one, yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you are embezzling embezzling dead mules.
That's right.
Hey, I hope you can find a buyer. I really do. I wouldn't know where to move that kind of hot ice, but if you know somebody, that's on you. That's fine.
I was hoping you fellers knew somebody who needed some mules. That's a shame.
So the whole truckload was just on spec? It was not delivered from point A to point B. It was delivered from point A to, I hear they need mules out west. If you just invest, then you can get a whole truckload of mules.
Listen, these mules were hot, okay? I need to unload them. Maybe you know somebody looking for a horse. I can pass them off as horses.
Okay, well, I will say Deborah manages the Taco Bell and does not appreciate those kinds of jokes.
Hold on, don't the Taco Bell, huh? Hold on.
Don't even ask.
I got two mules. They're not spoken for.
People tell her those jokes all the time.
All right.
And she does not appreciate it.
All right, so fine.
Don't think you're going to get a customer.
I could tell the difference when I make, out of roadside venison, I make a taco versus the tacos here. They're not the same.
Did I mention that these mules are natural?
Like they're not robots? I don't know. What do you?
They're not robots.
Should we bring in one?
I mean, is a horse naturally attracted to a donkey, or did it take some doing? You know, was it just was the first mule an accident, or was someone like trying to convince the horse? No, you got to get on that. It's just a little horse.
Don't
worry about the ears.
Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about the ears. It's just a little horse. And yeah, it makes some funny noises, but, you know, she grew up, she's a foreign horse. She grew up in somewhere else.
Funny story is a donkey brays. That's the sound a donkey makes. My name's Mick Brayer. And so I come from a long line of donkey breeders, son of the Brayers.
All right. So it's in your blood.
That's right.
So it's like you have a right to these mule. If you run across a mule, you're like, this is my ancestral property.
It seems correct. Yeah.
Were they all from one place that they were pilfered? Or did you have to get them from a neighborhood?
Had to round them all up.
Did you blow a pipe, for instance, and all the mules came running?
My family has an ancient practice of assembling mules. That's right. It's like a flute, but it's an ancient version of the flute. Kind of like a pan or something like this.
Mm. And that so offended Bill that he fell off the call. I think that's a good sign to wrap up that particular scene.
That was something.
That was something. I think you've helped us set some parameters.
We now know.
For how the mythology
right.
of the campaign setting can grow.
It's going to grow for sure.
All right. Bill has emailed me. His internet just quit. So that doesn't sound like he's going to be back this minute. All right. Well, let me ask you a few more.
Sure.
Getting back to the mule meat.
Right.
The matter. When are they going to fire you for doing your podcast? When's that going to happen?
They could fire me any moment.
What they tell me about academia, I not being in academia at this point, is that you got to walk on pins and needles. You got to walk on eggshells. You got to walk on all the fragile stuff because you're going to say something wrong. You're going to get canceled.
Yeah. Fortunately, our audience is very small. And so I'm not – I will say like I had a board member mention, I saw you do a podcast. I was like, oh, God, please don't listen to it because – you're exactly right. Like we did a Christmas one on Dickens, Christmas Carol. I thought that was pretty good. But you're right. By and large, like I'm cutting up and I'm like, I realize that this is now people now perceive me in the world as like this guy who talks about, you know, mules and stuff like this. But it's okay. You know, I you're right. There is a certain danger to it. But, you know, I have tenure now. I don't know. What are they going to do at the end of the day?
Now you can change the system from within.
That's right. We change the system from within. Yeah, I think people sort of like it. I think they realize that it sort of attracts some students, I think, which is kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings people in, you know, people know who I am now and out in the very, very large world of ancient Greek political philosophy. I mean, that very enormous scholarly community. I now have a little bit of street cred in that community. So we've gotten some big names. I mean, we've gotten CDC Reeve, who's the big Aristotle translator, and we've gotten like Ferrari, who does some work out in California on Plato. We do veer into the series occasionally, but yeah, occasionally I got to get my co-host and be like, guys, you got to tamp it down a little bit. I do try to keep my job here. So
maybe the main difference between our format and yours, I mean, the Partially Examined Life, not whatever the, the hell this is
this is great, by the way.
Oh, I'm glad you're enjoying it. I'm glad to have you here.
Thanks.
Is how much we rely on experts. Like, of course, anybody who's doing scholarship in an area has a lot to say.
Right.
And actually, I was looking through your recent episodes to try to find out like what you specifically might be have been thinking about recently. But oh, I think the Odyssey was the most recent one that I found.
Yeah.
That was actually just the three of you.
That one starts off on a really weird note, if I remember.
Yeah, as opposed to, well, when you have somebody come in and do a research dump on you, are you reading their book, their article, their something? But yet you only have, you know, that long to talk. We found when we got too many people who were too educated that we felt like, well, why did I spend 5 hours reading this thing when I only got to talk for 10 minutes of the 50?
Oh, I've been there. I've been there. I'll tell you, one of my favorite is a professor. He's like, ask me this question. He emailed me ahead of time. I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. And I asked him the question, and while we're recording, he says, well, that's a stupid question. What? Why would you think of – it took everything I had to be like, dude, this is the question you wrote. But yeah, it happens. You're right. Sometimes you're overprepared. I'm sure you learn, Mark. Like sometimes when I have a strong guest and I know him, I can say, okay, I can kind of rely on him to sort of carry the bulk of this. But yeah, there are plenty of times where I do a lot of work and it doesn't seem to pay off. But what am I thinking about now? I sort of have two main areas that I'm kind of – thinking about mostly. One is I'm writing a book on Xenophon's Education of Cyrus and speaking about naturalness in this episode, about how there seems to be a natural limit to the size of political communities and that Cyrus is trying to make a worldwide empire and it seems to degrade fundamentally the humans under his rule. He's trying to sort of divinize himself in a way. So that's one project, and that's kind of a fun thing that I've been working on for a few years. But the second is I mentioned a couple times in passing that I've been reading through Aristotle's scientific writings with three friends, and that's been just immensely rewarding. We get together once a week on Tuesday evenings, and we've been reading a chapter or two at a time. We went through the entire Argonaut, now we're on Dianema. I think we're going to go through like meteorology next. So
yeah, I mean, I enjoyed Dianema quite a bit. We did a 2-episode run on that.
That's right. I remember. I listened to those, by the way. They're helpful.
But doing the physics, I mean, is there a more overtly like detailed biology work, right, than Dianema?
Oh my God, it's so hard.
Okay.
It's so hard. Yeah, yeah. It's great. I mean, I feel like I've made some progress. And so you realize, hey, here I am. I've been doing this for 20 years. And I've read some of these works when I was a young man. I wrote my dissertation on Aristotle. So I read some of this kind of as preparatory or sort of like, I should at least be informed on this stuff if I'm going to write on the ethics. And man, I'm just thinking how much I got wrong and how much I didn't quite comprehend and how much I didn't grasp. And so it's, on the one hand, it's sort of like discouraging. But on the other hand, well, here I am and I have some time and, you know, you can do it. Really, the question that's puzzling me right now is, what does it mean to know something? And I think the physics is part of that, right? So what is the soul? And the soul seems to, I've just been working through book three right now on how does the intellect think things?
So the physics is presenting basically the epistemology, just like Descartes and his ilk that, you know, because they learned so much about optics, this is why they were so interested in epistemology. All right. So this goes all the way back to that. We haven't even identified the science of knowledge necessarily as a separate thing. It is part of the organism interacting with the environment physically.
Right.
And so, yes, knowing all this archaic science.
Yeah.
I guess I'd be more on board with spending more time with that. And I have enjoyed some voyages in this area that I didn't think when I was in grad school, I wouldn't have put up with.
Yeah.
If it seems like some intellectual history came out of it in terms of, oh, well, if you want to understand vitalism in the 19th century, then you got to understand the world soul.
Right.
What was the history of that
notion?
I mean, that fascinates me.
Yeah, for sure. You're interested in the development of these theories over time and stuff like that, then a good deal.
Yeah. I mean, you always get a better idea of like where this, I don't know, just even the first time reading Kant and faculty psychology is so bizarre.
Yeah.
Like, why are you talking like this at all? And so it just begs you to take a few steps back further in history to see why they were talking about this.
Right,
the traditional arguments for the existence of God are so absurd that you want to, why would you think that this is the case? Where did the ontological argument come from? And looking at that sort of history. So yeah, I've gotten way into things that if I was just trying to apply the difference between academic philosophy and public philosophy, what the average person wants to get to an answer.
Right.
So, you know, tell me how to live. So I'll do ancient stoicism because it's telling me directly how to live.
That's why it's so popular. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but that it almost seems self-indulgent to just look into the history of ideas where I'm really just trying to see how these things fit together in a narrative, in a puzzle, that it's just intrinsically interesting as opposed to it is going to spill into some different way that I could live. Do you feel like we have the right to be boring, as artsy musicians would put it?
No, I think you're right. I mean, look, there's a reason I do the podcast. There's a reason. I mean, even the Zenovan book I mentioned is, I mean, it's not going to be sold at Barnes & Noble probably, but you know, it's still a little more like, what's the payoff? What does this have to teach us today about the nature of tyranny, for example, and worldwide empires and stuff, which I think is still germane, still relevant today. But on the other hand, I'm increasingly interested in things like you said that are, I mean, to be frank, I confess, is mostly just self-indulgent. I'm just trying to figure stuff out for myself. But I teach, you know, and I have the podcast and I do some writing and I actually do some popular writing as well. I mean, like, again, popular. It's not like I'm selling Lady Gaga albums or something like this, but... And so you're right. There is a certain sense of or a duty or an obligation to kind of take what's the payoff for folks? What are we doing? What are we actually doing here? How are we helping people live better lives? I think that's an important part of what we do. And if we're only doing the self-indulgent stuff, you're not going to be able to do that for very long, probably. People won't let you do it.
I'm just hoping to be able to demonstrate that what I might have considered at some point self-indulgent is actually still fun.
No, it's so much fun.
And that is the appeal. It is the activity of doing it itself, and that it's actually probably snake oil to think that this is going to lead you to, you know, a direct practical application. This overall suspicion of self-help books and self-help philosophy.
All that stuff I find sort of, that's probably not going to work.
Does it seem even more galling when it pulls on ancient sources like use the ancient teachings of Lucretius to make more money and get more chicks?
I don't know if you've considered pitching that precisely, but that was a very that was a very well done segment there. No, you're right. Sometimes I hear this stuff and I'm like, oh God. And then it's clear that they haven't read the thing or that they're at least trying to peddle some watered down or ridiculous version of it. Yeah, that's very common. Stoicism, which to be fair, I suppose if there is an ancient philosophy that a sort of popular version of it could actually help people, maybe it is Stoicism. But even then you're sort of like, okay, but it's much more complicated than that. And there are the pleasures of the mind that Stoicism talks about, all these kinds of things. So
if only there were podcasts dedicated only to Stoicism, then you could look into the ins
and
outs.
They could listen to this.
Those are our main competition, I think.
Is that right? I bet. That one's pretty popular, yeah.
Well, there are several. It's not just one.
Stoicism Today is one of them. Is that something like that?
The Daily Stoic we've had on this
show. Daily Stoic,
that's
it. Yeah.
But yes, there are several.
Yeah. Not a lot of Daily Epicureans, kind of sadly enough. What you should do is just eat a lot.
You'd sort of run out of that.
Yeah.
You could read his entire the entire Tribute to Corpus. And
I don't think people need a podcast if that's the vulgar life they want to live. Like, oh, it's vulgar Epicureanism.
I'm going to do a whole podcast based on Anaxagoras. And, you know, we'll get through all and it's going to run 5 years. It's only going to be Anaxagoras. I'd be making up shit.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. Well, I'd love to talk to you again.
Yeah, please.
On the big stage, because we still have never done any Xenophon. I tried to get the guys to do his version of Socrates, like within the last couple of years, inspired in part by listening to your show.
Oh, thanks.
And like how much that you got out of him. And for whatever reason, it did not make. There are things that list exist on the list, and they don't.
Plenty of things on the list. If they ever change their mind, I'm down anytime to talk about Xenophon. It'd be a lot of fun.
All right. Good chatting with you. So long, everybody.
Nice chatting with you. Tell Bill we said hey.
All right. Bye, everybody.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, we got Bill back. We have kicked Greg off.
Yeah, good.
It's the next day.
No, sorry about that, everybody. Continually having issues, and I apologize.
Just make it their problem. I know it was your problem, but now it's their problem because they missed you. They cry.
It seems like every time there's a guest, I get kicked off.
I know I've gotten kicked off in the middle before. At least, so we had gotten far enough in the scene that it was totally fine to stop. We had milked that scene quite a bit.
Yes. Well, I was enjoying talking with Greg. I thought he was game and fun and had some cool things to say.
Yes. I had, in fact, reached out to him earlier that day to pitch the empty street idea and say, well, what I asked him to do was think about what professional philosophers do versus what philosophy in the culture is. So
sure.
What would a long-haul trucker, our typical guest, you know, at least a good first guest for this thing, what do they think about philosophically. But I forgot to actually ask him that question when he was playing the character. So instead, we were talking about the logistics of what are you hauling? How do you do it? Do you use showers?
Well, I think he revealed some of his philosophy of how he feels about the world in there.
Mm.
And it's only a job, and he's willing to sell his load if it means he can make more money, you know? I think there's a very individualistic ethos within the long-haul trucker community that he embodied.
I just got to see, if I'm trying to play a Socrates sort of character, then you got to assume that Socrates had to work at it a little bit. Because in our first one, I just was kind of, oh, you like your job? You like getting paid for your job? And just kind of let your answer be. I didn't like harass you. Yeah. But on the other hand, I don't want to make this a me and the other person dialogue. I want it to be a three person or, you know.
Yeah, certainly.
A well-balanced. Socratic dialogues are not known for being that Socrates and his interlocutor have the same number of lines. That's not.
Sure.
So we're not doing that.
Yeah. He didn't wake up one day as Socrates. It took time to become Socrates. So I think that's fine. I think we should give you the same grace and allow you to discover Bertrates as we go along here.
Maybe someday we'll get last names.
Yeah, I think I like just leaving that open, and there could be something that ends up supporting what the story is. Or did Socrates have a last name, or was that his last name?
They didn't have last names back then.
Okay,
it's like Socrates from.
Oh, yeah.
That's the best they would do.
Yeah, Gary from Madison? No. Gary from Fond du Lac. Oh, okay.
But they had a wider variety of names, it seems, to choose from, so.
And fewer people. It hadn't become an issue yet. Maybe it was starting to become an issue.
Heli R, which I just said, we actually recorded one on Severance yesterday with Pretty Much Pop.
Sure.
And I forgot to sort of bring up that, you know, how they have last initials, even though there's no other person of that name. That's what we would do in second grade, is everybody would be their first name, except I'm Mark L, because there's Mark.
There's a second Mark.
F as well.
Yeah.
So after you jumped off, I just talked to him more about the book that he was writing. And
Yeah.
If we have an academic on who is not actively promoting their book and has a whole agenda, probably that's the default, is like, well, what are you working on? What are you doing? Let's see if we can mine something out of that.
Mm-mm.
Did you feel like there was a particular philosophy lesson?
Yeah. The nature of nature and natural.
Oh, yes, of course.
And just how often that gets thrown around kind of knee-jerk wise, like we all get it right, as almost as an understood, I'm sure there's a name in philosophy for those things we all accept to be true without having to explain them, a given. And just, you know, we need to be more judicious about what we give the title of natural to. Not that it does not exist, or that there aren't things that are approach natural or approach a given state of affairs, but we need to not throw that around. I'm sure there's one of those logical fallacies that gets those lists that get thrown around the internet.
There's a specific one called the naturalistic fallacy by G.E. Moore.
There we go.
Early 20th century philosopher, the logical error of assuming that just because something is natural, it must be good or morally right.
Yes.
And I'm sure we did this in some form on some past episode. I'm no longer keeping the spreadsheet updated that I had for a while so that I wouldn't repeat myself.
We're past that. We're through the looking glass here. There's definitely some human there. There's definitely some is-ought, you know, going on in there.
Yep.
And we assume that nature is this perfect is. It is the objective truth. So then we presume to be, well, then that's what we should measure everything against, isn't it? That's the yardstick from God. So that's it. But I guess that's not really the case, is it?
And you have shown that you have learned philosophy over the years, that you identified that correctly.
Yes, I'm doing it.
Yes, I know we did that in some past episode, but I couldn't tell you what. So that's good that you, when you just remember the information, you don't remember where you got it.
Exactly. And can't credit it.
Are there certain things where you remember very clearly where the origins of the ideas? Like if I'm just like, I think I saw that movie, but I don't necessarily for every single movie remember what the setting was where I saw it. But if I like hear, oh, this piece of wisdom attributed to this musician.
Mm-hmm.
Or the first time I was, you know, when was I first, did I learn about this band? When did I see them live? Like that stuff I all pretty much, until my mind falls apart, which, you know, is on the way. But like, I feel like that's the kind of thing.
Well, I could definitely see like if there's a circumstance around having seen it or around remembering, it was just like, well, it was Tuesday and I was bored, so I went to the movies, you know, as opposed to it was the first movie. Me and all my friends from high school, you know, one of us turned 16 and we all borrowed the parents' car and, you know, car, you know, it's, there was some story around the circumstance that I could see that being more memorable than just rando.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing. Do you when you're talking to your spouse?
Yeah.
Do you remember? You're like, didn't we see that movie together?
Yeah.
And she's like, no. Like, well, I saw it with somebody. I guess it wasn't you.
Yeah.
And yeah, it can usually put it back together. Like, oh, that's the time I went with your mom and your nephew. And okay.
Yeah.
Without you.
Yeah.
Because that was a rare enough thing.
Yes.
And then was there an improv lesson?
Well, I mean, kind of like you talked about, this notion of you may have intended to talk about philosophy things and be Socratic, but we also have to be true to the moment. And it's not propaganda. We don't know what it will be or presume to know what the message is until we get in and start doing it. And we have to be, I wouldn't even say flexible, because that implies that, well, there's one thing is right, but we may need to change it. But it's like, no, we need to be open and aware to let the scene be what the scene is, as opposed to try to jam our idea on top of it. How does that sound?
That's good. And it sort of explains, I mean, you kept it nice, well grounded. It's good that we're only doing it for, not that we have to do it for the second half of every episode, but at least it's a thing to run with.
Yeah.
As opposed to trying to do it like, oh, this is the new format of the show. Like, we'll do,
sure.
We do for the first half and then save this for the second half.
I think that's fine.
But hopefully even within that, you would not feel like, oh, you're always the straight man.
I don't mind.
I think often the guest might be the straight man, and it was actually just, I think we emboldened.
Yes.
Greg seemed to be having a pretty good time and felt like he could be a little more ridiculous. And he was actually like, yes, an email a little apologetic about it. Like, no, it's fine. Because I think I commented after you jumped off, like, okay, so that's the limits of, we thought maybe.
Yeah.
We were setting up something with some level of seriousness. You know, I didn't really go into it, but it was at least a question in my mind. And I did remove, so it took me a while. I ended up editing our Empty Street episode, the inaugural one, two episodes ago, myself, because it was just the two of us.
Sure.
And that always just takes longer because I don't send it out to somewhere. But I wanted to save a little money.
Yeah.
And I felt weird enough about it, as I often do. But actually, I didn't realize that, like, the actual scene was only like the 15 minutes in the middle of the episode. Like, it was not most of the episode. We had plenty of stuff on both sides. I did delete one thing from canon about how the bird died, because the more I thought about it, I didn't think it made any sense. I didn't think it. So I wanted to leave it mysterious.
That's fine. Yes.
Like our last names.
To be discovered. We will get the opportunity to have those names be important or critical or somehow play a role in the plot. Why do it now if you don't gain anything from it?
All right. My mind is already spinning. I will keep myself from putting out possibilities now because we want to save them for the juicy parts.
Yeah.
Well, I sure learned a lot from you and our guest, Greg, today.
And I learned a lot as well.
I mean, yesterday, did I learn it? Well, okay. Yes. Mostly yesterday.
Things were learned over the course of the last collection of hours.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Maybe I should sell my soul. Bankrupt.